The following was originally produced for the national radio series Focus on the Family, featuring psychologist and best-selling author Dr. James Dobson. This cassette features a recorded message by Mrs. Carol Everett, a former abortion clinic operator who has become a Christian and given up her position. She provides a look inside an abortion clinic and explains some of the working procedures. This program was aired on Focus on the Family in the fall of 1988. Roughly a year after Mrs. Everett gave her presentation. Due to the sensitive nature of this subject, we would ask that you use discretion when you listen to this tape. There are portions of this speech that are very graphic and quite emotional. Focus on the Family co-host Mike Trout begins as he addresses Dr. Dobson.
Doctor, this is one of those series that we need to start off by saying there is graphic material we'll share and discretion needs to be used by our listeners.
That's right, Mike, especially with regard to children, but also to adults, perhaps women who have had abortions, people who have been associated with this industry one way or another. What we're going to hear is difficult. I feel strongly that our people, our friends, our listeners need to know what they're about to hear, and that's why we're airing it, but it will not be a pleasant subject. I have felt from the early days of the abortion business, certainly from 1973 when the Supreme Court legalized abortions in America, that one of the reasons this industry has flourished is because the truth is kept from the people. If abortions had to be witnessed, if the murdered babies could be seen, the public support for this awful practice would end. And I received a letter the other day from a lawyer, a man who wrote me a very complimentary letter, said he loved our broadcast and named all the things that he appreciated, but said, I disagree with you about abortion, and then went on to give what I consider to be a rather shallow explanation of his opposition. Mm-hmm. For that man, I hope he's listening, and for the others who are not sure how you feel about the matter of abortion, we are today airing a live presentation made by Carol Everett. Carol got into the abortion business. She made $150,000 a year. She had two clinics, and she's going to give us the inside story regarding what goes on inside an abortion clinic. Carol found the Lord on July 7th, 1983, and walked out of her abortion clinic that day, and has been working with the Right to Life Association in Dallas, Texas, ever since then.
She also has been speaking, I know, to groups in Canada, where I know this is an important issue that the government is dealing with.
Extremely so, yes. Because the Supreme Court up there just last year, I believe, struck down the laws against abortion. And so freestanding abortion clinics are popping up in various places. So this is a very important issue for our Canadian friends as well.
Let me restate the fact that the following is very graphic and very emotional, and we want to share that warning before we proceed with the tape of the story of Carol Everett.
Thank you. I believe some of my friends must have told you how frightened I was that no one would show up. I was so afraid that they said, owner, founder, operator, that they would think that I presently own, operate, and I don't. I'd like to give you just a brief history of how I came to get involved in the abortion industry, and let's don't forget it is an industry, one of the largest uncontrolled industries in our nation. But in 1973, abortion was legalized in the state of Texas. And in 1973, something else happened. I was married, and I had an 8-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son. And I found out I was pregnant. I was in the hospital for a DNC because I'd been bleeding for a very long time. And my doctor came in at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and said to me, let's go down and examine you. The pregnancy test came back positive. And I said, I've been telling you for weeks I was pregnant. And he wouldn't believe me. So he went down, he examined me, and he did tell me I was pregnant. We stopped the surgery. I called my husband and said, don't come into the hospital. I'm not going to have any surgery this morning. I'm pregnant. Now, this man was not nearly as excited as I had hoped he would be. Here I was, a mother of two, married, happily married, and thought I was finally old enough to have a child, and he just didn't have any enthusiasm in his voice. I went home that night. We worked that day, went home that night, sat down, and he said, you just got to have an abortion. Now, I really didn't think too much about it. I really cut off the conversation there. But I got up the next morning and called this doctor figure, this man who was an authority figure in my life, after all. My husband didn't want me to have the baby. Who could I turn to? And I said, Harvey, Tom doesn't want me to have this baby. And his answer was quite simple. He said, oh, well, we can take care of that. He didn't say, how do you feel about it? He didn't say, have you thought about this? He said, we can take care of that. What you do is you bring Tom's urine into the hospital. The pregnancy test will be negative. We'll do the abortion in the hospital, and your insurance will pay for it. That was the answer. It was the easy way out. I wish I could stand here today and tell you that I hadn't taken that way out, but I did. Now, I woke up that afternoon in the hospital from the abortion, and I picked up the telephone and decided to go to work. Started buying stocks for the doctor I worked for, little realizing that at that point I had already started running from the decision that I had made to kill my baby. Now, went home, everything was fine. Within 2 months, I had asked this husband, this man I loved so very much, to move out. Didn't realize that the abortion had anything to do with it. I'd started having an affair, not realizing I was running, looking for something to take away the hurt. Kept on and on and on, and by the end of about 5 months, I was seeing a psychiatrist daily, an hour a day, and calling him 2 or 3 times a day sometimes. My life had just been going along like this. The abortion happened, and it just went downhill. Now, the reason I tell you that is because sometimes we forget that the women who have abortions many times have had other abortions, and they're justifying it by having another one. The women who work and run abortion clinics are justifying what they've done by running and working in abortion clinics. So there's a lot of deception there. I didn't really deal with it. I finally had to get myself in gear and go on. My children were there, and I had to support them. So we changed everything I could, except the children. I changed my husband. I got him out of my life and away from me. And there I was, running, but I had to get control. And so I got control in the best way I knew how. I just worked as hard as I could, 12, 14 hours a day. And you know, when you have kids, there's baseball games and all sorts of meetings, Girl Scouts meetings and all sorts of things. So you get pretty involved in that. And you keep very busy, and you don't have to deal with what you've done. Well, that's exactly the pattern my life took. I ran for many years, and then I got involved with a man with a medical supply business. And here we were, abortion legal, and we had a new account selling a lot of xylocaine. Xylocaine is a numbing drug that they use to deaden the cervix. And he noticed this account was quite profitable, and he decided he really wanted to go in there and see what they were doing and why, how profitable it was. It was profitable for us, so we wanted to see how profitable it was for them. Found out it was an abortion clinic, went in and talked to their CPA, found out it was very profitable for them, and opened his own abortion clinic. Now, all of this time, he didn't know I'd had an abortion because, you see, I couldn't even deal with the fact that I had an abortion until last November, which may sound funny to you, but we'll go into that a little more. But he had these abortion clinics, and he kept inviting me to help him with them, to work in them, to do get involved in them. I kept saying no, no, no. Couldn't quite bring myself to do that. He went from one abortion clinic to 4 abortion clinics. It was quite lucrative. The first year with one clinic, his income went from $24,000 one year to over $125,000 the next year. And he didn't even get started early in the year. That was not a full year. I don't remember the exact dates. Then by the time he had 4, he wouldn't even tell me how much money he made. But then he finally came to me one day. I went in to quit. I said, hey, I can't make enough money working for you. I have 2 children going to college. I have got to make some money. So he had the answer. He was going to pay me $2,152 a month to go around the state of Texas and, incidentally, Louisiana. So I have been to Louisiana before, been to Shreveport, to set up these clinics that would indeed be sanctioned nonprofit by IRS, and they were. We got our 501c permit, and then we would funnel. They were run under the guise of doing sexual counseling. The only sexual counseling we did were free pregnancy tests, and we funneled all of those abortions directly into his clinics in Dallas and Fort Worth. If they were in Louisiana, we sent them straight to Dallas. We didn't tell them where else they could stop and what else they could do. The only place we told them they could go were those clinics. We're very, very profitable, and we're doing quite well. Our goal was to have 7 around the state of Texas and Louisiana, and we were going to eventually open the first abortion clinic in the state of Louisiana. Thank God we weren't able to do that. Someone else beat us to it. But We kept on going, and finally one day the call came, Carol, I have fired my director. Please come in and run the clinic until I can find someone who can just step in here and take it over. So I finally bit the apple and went in the clinics. Went in there, they were doing less than 200 abortions a month. So I decided rather than get involved in the abortion, I'd get involved in the numbers. And that indeed I did. Within just a few weeks, I had doubled his business. And so he sent me over to the Fort Worth clinic because that wasn't good enough. They were doing about 200 a month. When I left, he was doing over 400. When I stopped working for Chuck Osborne, the good Catholic boy, he was doing over 800 abortions a month. The reason I stopped working for him is because I went in one day and said, Chuck, you're making so much money here. It's directly my efforts that have done it, and I really want you to give me an equity interest in the clinics. He said, no, can't do that. So I methodically did all the things I had to do. I needed some surgery, so I had the surgery. I needed my teeth worked on. I had my teeth worked on. I did everything his insurance would cover, and I set up my own Yellow Page advertising in the Dallas-Fort Worth directories so I'd be ready to go in 6 months, and that's exactly what I did. I opened a clinic over on Mockingbird in Dallas, and the first month we did 45 abortions. The next month, 65, 85, and just straight on up. The last month I was there, we did 565 abortions. Now, our plan was to have five clinics around the Dallas area. And what we intended to do was bring them in from all around the states, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Louisiana, as far as we could reach. Our Yellow Page budget was $250,000 a year, and in order to be a national account, you have to advertise in five states, which we did. So we were going to put all these people right into all this little nucleus of abortion clinics in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We had two clinics going. We're about to open our third. I was making $150,000 a year. I was compensated per abortion. I got $25 every time there was an abortion done. So you might know what my motivation would be. Was I going to be honest with anybody when they asked me any questions? If they asked me if it was really a baby, was I going to say yes? I mean, that's just where people are in the abortion clinic. We'll talk about that more in a moment. So here we were. But what you've got to remember is the abortion clinics are Satan's stronghold. And don't ever forget that. Don't forget that this is one of his big holds on our nation. And there's so much trouble in there, so much chaos. And some of the partners, we had three partners, and one of the other partners and I were having trouble. So I went to our financial advisor and said, we're not going to get through this. So please, please help me. Mark, I never cry, but today I'm doing it again. Anyway, here we were. So I went to the financial man and said, bring somebody in. Let's get this problem straight. We've got to go on. And so he called in this man who counseled with each of us for 1 hour. And then he set us all down together. And here we were, one more hour, and he handed us a piece of paper with 6 points on it. Now, I liked this guy when I saw this piece of paper because all six of these points were in my favor. I thought, hey, this is not going to be so bad. It's going to be great. He said to the other partner to get out of the clinics, to leave me alone, not to call, not to bother me, to write a letter if they needed money or something like that, but just get a check. Don't come in the clinic. And I thought, this guy is great. I'm going to love this. We're going to be able to go on. But we had to agree to meet with him for 4 more weeks, 1 hour each. Well, I thought, boy, as much as he's on my side, I'm not going to have any problem. This is going to be a breeze. So we met with him for the other 4 weeks. The second week, I started asking him questions because he had this unbelievable peace about him I had never seen in anyone before. Just this unbelievable peace. So I started asking him questions. He really didn't answer very many of them, but finally I said to him, are you a preacher? And he said, yes. And I said, what in the world are you doing in this situation? And he said, God sent me. And I said, God sent you? Wait a minute. Now, I forgot to tell y'all, I was a very deceived Christian. I had my Bible in the top drawer of my desk, and if anybody came in there, I would tell them that I was helping women. I was right where God wanted me, and I knew I was. I told this man, hey, God doesn't talk to people like that. And I know I'm a Christian. I tithe, blah, blah, blah. And he sat there and looked at me, and finally, when I shut up and stopped telling him what God was, we got a little deeper into it. He told me that through very much prayer that the Lord had asked him to come into this situation, to stay in there for 30 days and get this one person in this situation that he wanted out. When he originally came in, he thought it was either me or the doctor. By this time, he knew it was me. And we walked out in 27 days. Praise God. It wasn't quite that easy. It's him. it wasn't quite that easy. You know, your life doesn't just change in one prayer, but I certainly got it started changing. I started telling people I was leaving the clinic. My children supported me. A few other people supported me. But a lot of people told me how crazy I was. Now, here you've got to remember that I'd worked several years to make this kind of money, and I'm not an educated woman. I'm not even a real qualified ditch digger, so $150,000 or $1 million a year looked pretty good to me. So everybody was telling me how crazy I was, and I was beginning to wonder. So finally, one day, in the floor of that abortion clinic, I dropped down to my knees and said, Lord, if there is a Lord, if this is not where you want me, hit me over the head with a 2x4. And I say constantly, it was a 12x12. There was no question in my mind. Channel 4 did an expose on, Channel 4 in our area did an expose on clinics who were doing abortions on people who were not pregnant. It was about our two clinics, and they were right. That was my answer to prayer, and I had this incredible peace, and I was able to walk out right into my wilderness and know that the Lord went with me. And now what I do is go around and tell people like you what I know about what happens inside an abortion clinic. So I'd like for you to take the time, if you have a pen, a piece of paper, to write down your questions, because when we get through here, when I get through talking to you, I'm going to take you on a walk through an abortion clinic. I want to answer every question that you have in your mind, no matter how foolish it may sound to you. If you want to know what happens, I'm here to tell you. Let's talk about what happens when they call. First of all, the people spend a lot of money on advertising, getting people to call them. It's very important. Look at all your Yellow Pages. No telling how many Yellow Pages directories you get at your home. I get about 6 or 7 at my home in Dallas. And in every one of them, there are abortion ads and the 800 numbers calling free. Well, those things cost them a lot of money, so we know they're spending a lot of money there. When they call, they're answered by people who are paid by the abortion clinic. Now, the reason we know there's deception in there is these people are not paid by pro-life people. Their checks are written by pro-choice or pro-death people, whichever way you want to look at it. So their motivation is certainly to get them in there. And they are instructed not to rock the boat. They are told when they call that they are not to answer any questions they don't ask, meaning if they don't say, does it hurt, don't tell them it hurts. As a matter of fact, if they say, does it hurt, you say no. It's a slight cramping sensation. Your uterus is a muscle, and it's a small cramp to open it when you dilate it, a small cramp when it closes, and it's nothing. But in fact, it's excruciatingly painful. Another thing that they ask is it a baby? And the stat answer is no. Now, they may call it something different. Products of conception, a blood clot, tissue, anything, maybe even a fetus, but never a baby. And those people in there know it's a baby. I want to tell you something else here. You know those little feet pins? Those things used to irritate me to death when I was in the abortion business. I could not stand them. I would go in the grocery store, and this little girl in the line was about 16, and she'd have those feet on. And every time, I would just go crazy because she was shining truth on me, you've got to remember. And I couldn't understand it, but I hated them. So that's real important to us. Anything you have, as long as it's in love. So they call, and here's this girl, and they answer their phones, many of them, 24 hours a day. We answered ours 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And this girl on the other end of the line has just found out she's pregnant, and she's scared to death. And all she wants is an answer. And, you know, she may not even know she's calling an abortion clinic. She may think she's calling a crisis pregnancy center. But she gets this person on the end of the line who deceives her into thinking she's a friend, who sounds like the authority on abortion, who sounds like the authority on unwanted pregnancy. This woman is an authority figure to her, just as my doctor was to me. And she has all the answers. Come on in and have an abortion. That's exactly what she's doing. She's inviting her in for an abortion. Sounds as though she really has the answers. And so this poor little girl is scared to death. Here's this person with the answers. She's going to go ahead and make the appointment and go in. And when she gets there, they ask her to fill out a few forms. And they're very sweet to her and very nice to her. And they hug her. And she thinks it's love because she's so scared she doesn't know the difference. And they take her back to the lab. And they do a pregnancy test. And they prick her finger. And they're all patting her and being nice to her and all this stuff. So she thinks she's in the right place. They do a pregnancy test many times before they even get the results back. They'll send her back up to the front to pay. She goes up, pays. They give her a counseling form. She's put in this room to read this 6 or 12 page form, whatever it is. They say, okay, read through this, mark out in the left margin if you have any questions, and I'll be back in a minute to explain it to you. Here's this poor little girl, scared to death. Either her parents are going to find out, maybe even her husband, or something else. But fear is certainly motivating and gripping her at this point. They give her this form. She reads this thing about all these things that could kill her, scares her even more. So she just immediately signs this form as quickly as she can. They come back in. The counselor comes back in and says, do you have any questions? And she says, no. Or sometimes she'll say, does it hurt? And they go through the pat answer I've given you, no, it's a small cramping sensation. Is it a baby? No. Product of conception, blood clot, blah, blah, blah. Fetus, never a baby. What do you do with it? Well, we send it to the lab. They put it in the garbage disposal, but they don't tell her that. Sometimes they'll even charge her for additional lab work because there's something wrong with it, but very, very few ever go to the lab. They've stopped using the trash receptacles because us crazy right-to-lifers used to fish them out and go bury them. So now they put them down the garbage disposal, at least in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. That's what they do. So here she is, scared to death, finally has a counseling form signed. They give her medication. Now, if she wants to be put to sleep, they charge her an extra $100, $150. If she just wants to take the oral medication, they have samples that they've gotten from someone, and they give her the sample. Then she's taken into a room, and the so-called counselor goes with her. Now, they tell her that the counselor's there to be her friend and a helper. The counselor's there to keep her quiet, so the people who are being aborted in the other rooms can't hear her screaming if she starts to scream. And they tell her to breathe in and out, and they do all the Lamaze methods and all those things so they can try to control her to some degree. She's on the table, scared to death, so tense she can't stand it. The doctor comes in, sometimes says hello, sometimes says nothing. The people in the room laugh and joke, because you've got to remember, these people are having trouble with what they're doing, too. If you kill babies every day for a living, you have to deal with it some way. And they deal with it in different ways, by laughing, joking, turning the radio up so loud in the room that no one can hear them or think about what's going on. The nurses dance, the doctors joke. Here's looking at you when an eye goes through the tube. All sorts of things. But they have to deal with it, and that's what they do. So this girl is scared to death. They start the procedure, and sometimes she'll scream. Sometimes she'll just lie there and weep. But then they get her up, send her to the recovery room. And that's, there are two different kinds of reactions in the recovery room. It's amazing to me that some of them say, I've killed my baby. But that's the first time they ever call it a baby. That's the first time they ever think about killing it. But many of them do. Now, I think the girls that do that are probably going to be healthier about it. They're probably going to deal with it to some degree almost immediately. But then there are the other people, the people like I, who run and who don't deal with it, who say, hey, let me out of here. I want to go get something to eat. I'm hungry. You haven't eaten in hours. Those people are closing the doors, and they don't want to deal with it at all. Those people run out to run like I did for maybe as far as 14 years. You know, there's so many different statistics on the post-abortion syndrome. I believe it's 5 to 7 years is the average time that a woman deals with an abortion. But they don't deal with it right away. We need to pray for those women. They are deceived, and we need to take them the Lord's love. There are two other things I'd like to talk about before we start answering questions. Those are the women who come in who have abortions who weren't pregnant. You say, oh, that doesn't happen. Maybe you say that. It does happen. First of all, if this woman thinks she's pregnant, she's scheduled herself for an abortion, she's come in and her pregnancy test is negative, they have a woman that they paid their advertising dollars to get in there. They want to do that abortion if there's any way. So they do everything they can to prove that she's pregnant or has been pregnant. You say, has been pregnant? Yes. If they can convince her that she was pregnant, she's had a spontaneous abortion, she's going to have to go in the hospital and have the DNC to remove the rest of the contents of her uterus, they will convince her to go ahead and have a procedure she doesn't need that day. And it happens. I wonder, I mean, Channel 4 got it on tape, a woman that went directly from our office to a doctor's office, and the doctor told her she was not and had never been pregnant, and we had just tried to do an abortion on her. I don't know what percentage that is. I have no idea. But I will tell you something I'm not supposed to tell, but there are some people in our nation working right now doing that, trying to catch them. And the first week they went in 6 clinics, and they tried to do an abortion out of 6 people who went in not pregnant. 1 clinic tried to do an abortion on that woman, on one of those women. She went immediately there to a doctor's office and to an attorney's office, was confirmed not pregnant, and took all the forms to the attorney's office. So there's some people out there working to do some things right now, and that's getting me away from what I was talking about. The other thing are the ones that are too big, the ones that are over what they call their legal limit of 24 weeks or whatever it is in your state. These women come in, girls, young girls, teenagers, deny that they were ever pregnant, deny that they are pregnant. And so they come into the clinic almost in maternity clothes, literally, so big. Here they are, and the doctor looks at them, checks them out, and if he can get a picture on the sonogram that shows that they are within his range, a picture that he can put in the chart, he'll do that abortion. There are babies that weigh over a pound and a half that are aborted. There are certainly viable babies aborted in the state of Texas simply because the doctor can get a picture that he can do. And you've got to remember, one thing I didn't tell you is that the doctors make roughly a third of the fee. The clinics I was involved in paid in cash. They did not collect it through the clinic and show it paid out to the doctor. What we did was write two receipts to the girl. One for the doctor's fee, of which we kept no record. One for the clinic fee, which we did have a record. We had three doctors working on Saturday, and what we did was on a coupon system. We attached a coupon to the chart. The charts were kept in a central area. When one of those three rooms was available, that doctor's assistant would come in, pull out a chart, take it in there. When the doctor came to the door, the girl ready for the abortion, he would go in, take the coupon off the chart, fold it, put it in his pocket. At the end of the day, he would take his little coupons up and redeem them for the number of abortions that he had done that day. Now, let me make this clear. There were no records kept about how many abortions each doctor did that day. The way that we could reconstruct that, if we wanted to do that, would be go back and pull all the charts alphabetically, put them on the day that they were done, and then decide which doctor did how many abortions that day. Now, what we're getting at is they do not have to report that to IRS, so there probably, as we well know, millions of dollars unreported in our nation. Now, in our clinic, a doctor could easily make $1,500 on a Saturday. We charge $750 for what I call a third trimester abortion, and the doctor got $250 of that. So we would have doctors scheduling abortions at 7 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock at night if they could get me to do it in the clinic. And needless to say, because of my motivation, I would do it at any hour they wanted to. We also did abortions 7 days a week. Sunday was our most profitable day. It was the fastest day in and out. People came in there, just wanted to get their abortion and get out. So there was certainly a motivation for that. I've seen babies aborted. We had one that was so big it wouldn't go down the disposal. We had one that was so big it came out in two pieces, the head and the body. I asked a doctor not long ago, sat down with him and spent some time with him talking about that, and he told me that it was probably almost a term baby, simply because of what I could remember about it and the specifics. You talk about injuries. We talk about things that happen inside abortion clinics. Did you know that there are probably more deaths in the nation than we'll ever know? Because when someone dies inside an abortion clinic, the person that brought her in doesn't rush out and say, hey, I took her in for an abortion and she died, i.e. she's dead and I'm responsible. That doesn't happen. The parents don't say, I took my daughter in for an abortion and she died. When a girl dies from an abortion inside an abortion clinic, the abortion clinic has help in covering up because the family does not want to stand up and take the responsibility and they don't want to face the press. So there's really a cover-up in our nation of the number of people who are aborted and who are able to get away with that. Doctors are not reported if they can get it through without taking them. Many cities, of course, don't require autopsies, so the truth's never known about that. Although there are a lot of women, you know, there have been several in Dallas lately and around. You do hear of them occasionally, but only the ones that slip through. We had a death in our clinic. A 32-year-old woman with a 16-year-old and a 2-year-old child. It never got in the papers. It never got out anywhere. Nobody ever knew except us. This one girl that was 21 years old, and my son was 21 at the time. This beautiful girl came dancing, and I'll never forget her. Laid down on the table, and my position in this, and you may think, oh, well, she doesn't know. She was always up front. No, let me tell you, I was in the room. I was right there with the doctor. My right hand is what held those babies in place, the big ones. There were two doctors that didn't do big abortions unless I held the baby. And what you do is you hold it in place so that he can feel. You tell him where the head is. You tell him where the buttocks are. You tell him where everything is. And I had my hand on this girl's stomach, and we had the sonogram had showed that it was a perfect intrauterine pregnancy, meaning it was inside the uterus, and everything was normal. And the doctor went in one time, and he pulled out placenta, and the second time he went in, he came out with her bowel, and he pulled it through her vagina. And we took her to the hospital, and she had a colostomy. And she called me weeks later and told me she didn't feel pretty, and I knew why she didn't feel pretty. There was no lawsuit filed. There was nothing done. There were 7 doctors involved in that. If you pull those hospital records today, it will show that she had an abdominal pregnancy, meaning that they all said collectively that that baby was inside her stomach, in her abdomen, in her colon, and it was not. And we knew that. But if you pull her chart, all that's been changed. You can't find any records. If you pull the chart of the woman that died, you'll show that her blood pressure was always normal, that when we dismissed her, there was no reason to ever question that anything might happen to her, when in fact we'd had problems. She had problems before she left.
Well, you're listening to Focus on the Family, and we've just concluded a portion of a presentation by Carol Everett, and she spoke before a group and shared her own personal story. Doctor, I've listened to that just in the last 24 hours 3 times now, and I am still emotionally moved, especially there as she shares the details at the end.
Mike, as you and I listened, as you know, I fought the tears,
yes.
And I'm fighting them now. And I don't see how anyone could listen to those details and that explanation and not fully understand our incredible commitment to the pro-life position. We simply must rescue those babies and rescue those mothers, for they're the victims too.
Carol went on to take questions from the audience, and I believe you're going to have us listen to those questions and the answers.
There were many questions asked by the audience, as you indicated, pertaining to factual kinds of information, so we could understand what the abortion business is really all about. And we need to explain that the recording device that was there did not pick up the questions very well. We can hear them in the background, but they're not recorded well enough to be broadcast on radio. So we are re-recording the questions.
Recreating, yes.
That's right. Uh-huh. And so you will only hear Carol's actual answer as she gave it live on that particular day. But what you hear is someone in the studio asking those questions.
This group had just heard the presentation, and these were the questions that grew out of that message.
Did you have any pro-life people present during the days you operated the clinic? If so, in what ways did they protest?
We rarely, unfortunately, had pro-life presence at that time. I believe that pro-life presence in the doctor's office, abortion clinic, and home are the most important things that we, second most important things that we as pro-lifers can do. The first thing is pray. And then the second thing we can do, and of course you have to prayerfully consider this, is be there, be available. You might want to picket. You might want to just stand out there and love. I think it's very important that these girls know that we love them and that we're there to help them. I don't approve personally of screaming and yelling and all of that stuff, and I don't approve of picketing and hate. It's got to be love. But if you just stand in front of an abortion clinic, you turn the light on inside there. That doctor slows down. If a girl comes in who is not pregnant, he is less likely to do an abortion with picketers out front. If someone who comes in is too big, he's less likely to push her into an abortion that day, simply because they are so paranoid. They think that you're going to run into their clinic and chain yourself to the abortion table and stay there so they can't do abortions. To prove that, we had 5 locks from the front door to our procedure room. 5 locking doors. No swinging doors until you got to the very back. But I believe that the pro-life presence at the abortion clinics is far, far more positive. First of all, you don't know how many just turn away by seeing you out there. And then you never, of course, sometimes you can get a count but of how many go in and come out or how many keep from going in, but I think that's very important. Yes.
You mentioned that people should not only picket the clinic but the doctor's home. Could you give us some more thoughts on effective techniques against doctors? And also, could you explain more about what you did with the remains of the babies after they were aborted? You mentioned the horror that the doctors had to deal with.
We put them down. We had a heavy-duty garbage disposal. And it was one, I don't know if you know what that means, but let me tell you what it is. It goes both ways. When it stops going this way, it goes back around the other way, and that's what we did with them. And then the second question was, I mentioned picketing doctors' homes, and do I think that's effective? Many times, the doctors' wives and families and neighbors do not know that they're involved in the abortion industry. And what you do, and some of the picketers in the Dallas area have been directly responsible for two doctors stopping doing abortions just because of this one method. Because it turns on the light in their neighborhood and in their family, and then they have to deal with it on another level. And let's face it, if they're lying to their wives and their family and their neighbors, it doesn't hurt for us to get out there and love and show them the truth. There's a lot of anger involved in that. But as long as you're out there in love, and their offices, many times their own partners will not realize they're involved in abortion. That's very important.
We're always confused about how accurate the clinic reports are, where they concern any complications during or after abortion. In Texas, they're supposed to report if there's a medical complication or even a death. Are they really reported? Because when I've looked at the numbers, I haven't seen anything to indicate these kinds of problems.
Yeah. I really don't think, of course, the law in our state came into effect after I left the abortion industry in 85. And at the time I was involved, we didn't report any complications. We did not even report to the National Abortion Federation at the time I was involved with the clinics. They did not report their numbers at all. And there were several clinics in the area that did, but I could count when I left the abortion industry 1,200 procedures a month done in the Dallas area that I knew were not being reported to the Census Bureau in Atlanta or to the National Abortion Federation. Since then, in 85, we do require that they report all of their complications and everything to the state of Texas, the Licensing Bureau of the state of Texas. I believe that if there's a complication or a death or perhaps even a hospitalization, that those are probably pulled out. And the reason I think that is because you do the abortion and any complication that you have happens within the next few days. So you have time. You don't have to report till the end of the month. So it's real easy to find out which ones you need to obliterate from your records and know which one to go back. I would seriously question a great percentage of those being reported.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about the psychology and rationalization and the language used when you confront the actual body parts. You can say, well, it's not a baby when you don't see it, but I got the impression from you that you do see the parts. You're involved in actually holding the parts, disposing of the parts, and that type of thing. How can individuals deal with that psychologically and yet continue to do it? Is lying so powerful or rationalization so powerful that an individual can just die to reality, even though reality is right there before them?
You get so hardened to it, and what you're deceived first by thinking you're helping the woman. And they concentrate not on the baby, but on the woman. They don't see it as a murder. They see it as helping the woman. They don't see the death of that baby. However, even the people who were the hardest at times had trouble with putting those parts down in the disposal. I've seen eyes roll back. I've seen people do incredible things. But I think another thing that we're not really hitting on is they seem to go to the lower part of the socioeconomic scale to find people who cannot make this kind of money. See, in the abortion industry, they pay people enormous amounts of money for working there. A nurse who could probably make $9 a few years ago when I was involved would there make $11 or $12 in the abortion clinic. She could more or less set her own hours. She could come in on the day certain doctors work. She could work with certain doctors. There's a lot of flexibility. And, you know, when you're paid $2 or $3 or $4 an hour more, you tend to look the other way, especially if you look at somebody like myself who really can't make that kind of money. And I could make that kind of money there. You tend to look the other way because love of money creeps in there. And, you know, you've got all these responsibilities and deception. And I just think you start lying to yourself and you start joking about it and everybody's dealing with it, so it's this camaraderie about it.
What did you say to the girls as they were leaving the clinic? Did you give them any post-abortion counseling on something like having problems or complications?
They give them a sheet telling them all about what's happened and what's going to happen and what to expect with an emergency number. They're acting like they're friends, and they tell them, if you need help, come back. Very, very rarely will that girl ever come back, simply because the light is not turned on in that clinic. You know, she doesn't sense the real kind of help that she needs. we didn't see very many. Now, we would see girls, for instance, we saw a 13-year-old girl whose father brought her in for an abortion. She came back in with a piece of glass in her blue jeans, and after the checkup, attempted to slit her wrist in the procedure room, or in the checkup room. Now, that was, she was certainly crying out for help, and we tried to help her, but, you know, when you don't have any love, you can't give much. I just don't believe you see nearly the number that have problems. I believe that every 100% of people who are touched by abortion have a problem, either physical or mental, based on my own personal experience.
Could you address burnout and staff turnover?
Yes, the staff turnover, if they make it through the first 6 weeks, then they're deceived, and you've got them, and they're caught up in it, and they stay. Burnout, and what you see is the satanic hold on these people in their lives is that they come in and they're nice people and they've been married for 15 years and suddenly they're having an affair with one person and then suddenly they're having an affair with two people and then they're leaving their husband and losing their children. And the satanic effect just spreads throughout their whole lives. It doesn't just stop at the clinics. It goes on and on and on. So you have a tremendous turnout over, but what mostly very, very early. And if they make it deep into the cycle, then they just stay and stay and stay. They become very hardened, though.
You mentioned doing late-term abortions. I'm curious as to what kind of methods you used. Was it saline solutions?
We did not use prostaglandins and salines primarily because those babies could be born alive, and you did not want to take the chance of having a baby born alive, so we used the D&E method because there's no chance of a live birth.
What type of a physician is allowed to perform abortions? Do you just have to be any kind of a doctor, or do you have to be a gynecologist, or what do you have to be?
In the state of Texas, you just have to be an MD. In the state of Texas, we have doctors who are not on the staff of any hospitals, therefore have to pay someone to take their complications. In the state of Texas, we have people who are not members of medical societies or, you know, just not on staff in any hospital or anything. Because he has no hospital privileges, he either has to send them to the emergency room or pay someone to take his calls.
Could you give just a rough estimate of how many people, perhaps in a year's time, die in an abortion clinic or as a result of an abortion?
I really can't tell you how many die because, of course, I believe that those are not reported, but I can tell you that we were having a major complication, i.e. hospitalization requiring hysterectomy or blood transfusions, major hospitalizations, not minor hospitalizations, or a death out of each 500 patients we saw. One per 500, my personal hands-on experience.
If there are picketers outside the abortion clinic and information is given out, is that information effective? And do you see the effects of that, is what I'm saying, number one. And number two, is that confiscated when the woman comes in?
Yes, it's confiscated. It is quickly confiscated. And they tell you, oh, sorry, you had to go through that. Don't pay any attention to them. Sometimes it does good. Sometimes if that girl's heart's just a little bit soft, you'll see her go in and come out. I've even seen people get as far as the procedure table, get up, get dressed, and come out. Yes.
You talked about the levity and the joking around that was going on inside the operating room or the procedure room. Was there any indication, any sign of disrespect or contempt for the girls when they perhaps weren't in the same room with the workers or the doctors and nurses or even the counselors?
Yes. When they were asleep, they would talk about them, primarily their physical appearance, you know, joking about them and about how hard they were to get on and off the table and that sort of thing, calling them things like elephant and sort of things. A lot of joking about the girls, no respect whatsoever for anybody, not even themselves.
I really appreciate the tremendous frankness that you're telling us about the abortion clinic, but when you were caught up in this, could you have spoken or thought as frankly then as you do now? And also, what turned you around? What can we do to get other people out of the business?
Only the Lord. In November, I just was able to say I'd had an abortion. He continually shows me additional things that I saw for a long time. When I started speaking, and I started speaking April the 15th, 1985 at our Texas legislature, and when I made that first appearance, I could not tell you anything simply because I was still so deceived and there were so many, I was so bound up in it. But the Lord is working in my life, and my doctor, who is a pro-life doctor, said to me last Monday, Carol, remember we're onions. We're big onions, and we come off a layer at a time. And as you continue to grow, I can see the difference, and he was talking about the difference in my testimony. And he had seen me in Denton, and he said he could see a difference. And I think that the Lord is able to give me more and more freedom about what I really saw in there, what really happened, and call truth, truth. whereas there may be a lot left, and I'm certainly open to changing that. And then you talked about the, how we can help those people in the experience. I believe that the only answer we have is Jesus Christ. He's the only song I can sing. He's the only answer I see that we have for those people. What do we have to tell them about if they don't have the love of the Lord in their lives? And you see so many people who are involved in that, and I think that's because it is the only answer. And I think prayer is the only one. Ezekiel 11:19.
In our area, we have a crisis counseling center, and the local abortionist is really concerned about that. He asks every girl that comes into his clinic, have they been to the center? And then he tries to get them enraged that we've deceived them in some way. And I want to know, did you have any crisis centers near your clinic? And what did you do to change the girls around if they'd had any pregnancy counseling?
We did not have any crisis pregnancy centers around when I was there. And I believe that the reason this man is so angry with you is because, and is trying to talk to these girls, he's certainly directing a lot of energy toward that, and he is definitely being affected by you. His business is being affected. Everyone's being affected. You're doing a great job. Hang in there and keep praying.
Carol, how can we reach people who work at abortion clinics, including the doctors, after prayer and fasting?
My grandmother died the day I received Christ, and I believe I was the last grandchild to come to Christ. So I believe that prayer about them specifically is the most important thing we can do. I believe if we pray Ezekiel 11:19, take that hardened, hard heart and turn it to a heart of flesh about each and every person you know that's involved in the abortion industry anywhere, that that will change their hearts. There's no power greater than that. And love them. Love them. Don't stand out there and scream at them because they're deceived and they don't understand. And they need our love and God's love more than anything else. And we just have to love them. My best friend from that period of time is still involved. And I know God's going to bring her out. It's real easy in this is to get involved in righteous anger. But I think that the Lord tells us very clearly to hate the sin and love the sinner. Speak the truth in love, and I don't believe that we can righteously get angry at those people, only their sin. Yes.
Do you recall any situation where a woman who wanted an abortion but who couldn't afford one was given a free abortion or where this kind of social help was granted?
No, we did not. If you didn't have your money, you didn't get an abortion, and I don't know any abortion clinics that give them away.
Carol, you mentioned your best friend is still involved in the abortion procedures with the clinic. What has been your peers' reaction in that clinic to what you're doing now?
They hate me. They don't speak to me. Of course, we come in contact in legislative appearances and that sort of thing, and so they're there. None of them really will have much to do with me simply because there seems to be a fear of me. It's almost like there's a light that they can't put out, and they really don't want to deal with it at all.
In recruiting new employees, where would you publicize to get people to work for you?
We just put an ad in the paper if no one knew anyone. One of the things that you remember is we paid so highly that people would bring it. We had more applications than we could honor.
You said that you charged $750 for an abortion during the third trimester. How much was the fee for an abortion during the first or second trimester?
You've got to remember, I've been out of the abortion industry on that side for a long time. That was 4 years ago. It was July 27, 1983 that I became a Christian. So our first trimester abortions at that time were $185. I understand they're much more than that in that area right now, around $285, $280.
Were you in the National Abortion Federation as an operator, and did you attend any of their conventions, and what was the sort of, garbage or propaganda used at the convention?
We were members of the National Abortion Federation primarily because it was a good thing to be a member of, and we supported them financially. And we liked the spokesman they had in our area because she sounded good, she acted good, and she acted like she really cared about the people. She was a catalyst for us because we were able to stand behind her and greedily do our abortions while she really felt that she was doing the right thing. We really never attended their conventions or anything. It was just a bunch of baloney to us. We were in the business of doing abortions and making money.
Well, if you tuned in partway through our broadcast today, this is Focus on the Family. We've taken an interesting tact in our format. We're featuring a question and answer period that followed a presentation by a woman named Carol Everett. Carol ran two abortion clinics in Dallas, Texas, from 1977 to 1983, And she accepted the Lord in July of 1983 and turned an immediate corner and moved out of the abortion business and became a pro-life advocate. And, Doctor, she's been sharing with audiences for these past 5 years the kind of message we just heard.
Mike, there were so many things she said that I'd like to key off of. In fact, we could spend another 4 or 5 days talking about her comments. But that final comment there where she made reference to money, we were in it to make money, answers a lot of questions. Why do you suppose the so-called pro-choice people fight so vigorously to kill those babies? Why do you suppose the income to the ACLU exceeds the Rutherford Institute and the Christian Legal Society and other organizations that are fighting to protect babies? Why do you suppose the ACLU raises $50 for every one that's raised by the Rutherford Institute or the Christian Legal Society and some of the others that are working to protect traditional values? Where do you suppose all that money comes from? Why such a vigorous effort to lobby Congress? Where are the roots of this massive movement that would kill babies? It's in money. Mm-hmm. It is a highly lucrative business for everybody who's involved in it. And we've been hearing some of the details of that today.
Carol started off by saying that she wasn't making very much money as a single mother, and she needed to get into a business that would generate more income from her. Yeah. She was motivated right from the beginning by the need for a higher income.
And everyone working down to the hourly employees makes more money there than they can make someplace else. You just mentioned that. Mike, we've been dealing with the issue of civil disobedience. Operation Rescue in Atlanta and now in other cities across the country is growing, and people are getting involved in this blockage of abortion clinics. And people have asked, as Christians, where do we stand on this issue? I know one pastor in the South that I respect very highly has come out in opposition to any kind of civil disobedience on the basis of Scripture. Mm-hmm. And yet I think of Daniel going up into his room and opening the window where everybody could see and praying 3 times a day after Darius decreed that there would be no allegiance paid to any god but himself. I think of Paul and Silas sitting in jail for breaking the law. There's so many references in Scripture to civil disobedience when the people were adhering to a higher moral code. And in this context, I received a phone call from Life magazine not too long ago asking me what our position was on civil disobedience as it related to abortion. And I sat down and wrote a paragraph for them. They only printed about 3 lines of about a 15-line statement, which is perhaps
pretty much par for the course.
I'm afraid that's typical. So for the benefit of our friends, I want to read what I wrote. It's called Following a Higher Moral Code. I said, after World War II, German citizens living around Nazi extermination camps were required to visit the facilities to witness the atrocities they had permitted to occur. Though it was technically, quote, legal, unquote, to kill Jews and other political prisoners, the citizens were blamed for not breaking the law in deference to a higher moral code. This is the way we feel about the slaughter of 25 million unborn children. Some of them are being burned to death by a salt solution only days before normal delivery would have occurred. This is a moral outrage that transcends the law, which sanitizes the killings. We are a law-abiding people, and we do not advocate violence or obscene and disrespectful behavior. But to be sure, we will follow that higher moral code nonviolently to rescue innocent, defenseless babies. And someday, the moral issues involved here will be as clear to the world as the Nazi Holocaust is today.
I remember when I first heard you share that, we were in a hotel room in Atlanta speaking with Randall Terry and others who were involved in the Operation Rescue effort there. And that was a number of months ago. The world has not seen it your way yet, or seen it Randall Terry's way yet, have they?
They may not, but if nobody sees it that way, it's right. And I tell you what, Randall Terry and his wife and family and other people in Atlanta have put their lives on the line for those unborn children, and we stand shoulder to shoulder with them.
And with that, we come to the end of this Focus on the Family cassette. We hope that this presentation has enlightened you about the abortion issue and has challenged you to become more involved in the fight to protect the lives of the unborn. If you'd like to be kept informed about this and other family-related matters, Focus on the Family publishes a monthly magazine that addresses these types of issues. It features 16 full-color pages of interesting articles, news and such from Washington, D.C. on issues that impact the family. Dr. Dobson answers your questions, letters from readers, the upcoming broadcast schedule, and print and audio resources for the home. You can write to us and request a free subscription. Our address is Focus on the Family, Pomona, California, 91799. And thank you for listening.